Yeah.
If you're the police, where are your badges?
Badges? We ain't got no badges. We don't need no badges. I don't have to show you any stinking badges.
Forget it, Jake. It's Chinatown.
What we've got here is failure to communicate.
I'm a man. Well, nobody's perfect.
Fasten your seatbelts. It's going to be a bumpy night.
He wins, he takes the car. I win, I take his finger. Is that so strange?
Leiningen, you're up against a monster 20 miles long and 2 miles wide, 40 square miles of agonizing death. You can't stop it.
I'm as mad as hell, and I'm not going to take this anymore.
Round up the usual suspects.
Silent Breed is people!
Wait a minute. Wait a minute. You ain't heard nothing yet.
Welcome to Paleo Cinema Podcast.
Paleo Cinema Podcast is a fortnightly podcast about movies. All kinds of movies. Crime movies, science fiction movies, horror movies. Movies with cool actors you've never heard of in them. Movies where CGI stands for criminals, girls and ice picks. Classic movies, cult movies, and any other movie Terry wants to rant about as long as the movie is more than 20 years old. You can find the podcast website at paleo-cinema.com. The voicemail number is 206-350-5440, or you can email or send MP3 voicemails to cultguru@gmail.com. That's cult with a K. This podcast usually contains swearing and is probably not safe for work unless you work in a brothel or a David Mamet film.
Hi, and welcome to Paleo Cinema Podcast number 88. My name's Terry Frost, and this time around, I'm not entirely sure what I'm going to be doing. Now, before you turn on to another podcast, maybe about sex or something like that, I am going to fill the hour or so with something, but at the moment, we're in the middle of the household renovations. And it means that I can't get at my DVD library because there's a whole bunch of shit from other rooms piled in front of it. Just kind of picture last scene from the first Indiana Jones movie, and you'll get a little bit of the idea about what I'm talking about. So what I'm going to do instead is just, in general, talk about movies and see how it goes. Could be total shit. Could be okay. I'm hoping for the latter. So, how is everybody? Over here, summer is coming in. It's not quite here yet, but springtime is. And as I look out of the window of the podcasting headquarters, there's no grass in the backyard. Yesterday, some guys came around with a bobcat and a dingo and scraped the dirt bare in our front and backyards. Now, this means, well, they also knocked over a couple of pipes they've got to repair. So, the outage pipe to our ensuite shower has been wrecked. And there is an access outlet to the main drain that sits in our backyard under a steel cap. That's been busted too, so the guys have got to come back and fix that. It's all part of the fun of renovating. But things have been a bit chaotic, and I really haven't had the time or the mental capacity to do too much pre-planning for this one. So I apologize for that. Real life does interfere at times, and I hope you guys and ladies will bear with me while it does. It won't be too much longer, but just at the moment, things are fucking chaotic. So it's probably about time I talked about what I've been watching, so I'll crank up the Mizo and see how we go. I did do a few movies for the radio, which I always kind of enjoy doing. Most recently, next movie I'll do, in fact, is Hitchcock's Vertigo, which I'll talk about when I hit the V part of the podcast A to Z project. We're onto the K's next time around, so we're still on track for that. And the one I did, so next one's Vertigo, I haven't watched that yet, but the one I did just record last night, just after a torrential rainstorm, down at ABC South Bank Studios, was The Man from Hong Kong. I've already talked about it on the podcast, but I thought I'd do a little bit of exploitation for the people in the ABC Northern Territory, partly because there is that great kung fu battle between Roger Ward and Sammo Hung, on top of what people know as Ayers Rock, but is actually called Uluru. and that is in the Northern Territory. So I thought I'd do a little bit of topicality and get a bit of Ausploitation crossed with Kung Fu movie, crossed with local content for the people in the Northern Territory by doing that. And Ivor thinks that we did well with it. I really enjoyed the chat with him. He knew for a long time Grant Page, the stunt guy, from Man from Hong Kong and a whole bunch of other things, including Road Games. He was the main villain in Road Games, the serial killer you might remember, who was hassling Stacey Keach and Jamie Lee Curtis. That's Grant Page. He was also in Stunt Rock. He was in a bunch of other things as well. So Ivor told me this great story about Grant Page and him, which I probably can't tell you, but it's hilarious and shows that, I just can't tell you, but it's a great story. If you want to talk to me on Skype or something, I'll tell you what it is. But I'm not really telling it in the public forum because it does involve doing illegal things. But, yeah, so it was great fun talking to Ivor about that. He knows a lot of people from the Ausploitation era. He was in Sydney at the time. He's an artist, amongst other things, apart from being a very fine late-night radio disc jockey. And, yeah, he's a lovely guy too, and he's been very supportive of Sal and I recently, and he's just a joy to work with, and I really do get a lot from chatting with him on the radio and that kind of opportunity to take things in a new direction. I keep saying that, but it really is a fun thing for me. So I did Man from Hong Kong. What have I watched out recently? I'm actually going to save that movie. I'll talk about it a little bit later when I'm talking about movies. I saw Monsieur Hulot's Holiday again, the Jacques Tati movie, because I love Jacques Tati movies. I watched that. I did get the Blu-ray of X-Men First Class because we're collecting those on DVD, so I like that. Fassbinder, fantastic actor, totally blew everyone else off the screen. When he's on the screen, you can't look at anybody else. Just Michael Fassbinder, fantastic actor. Really enjoyed that. I did check out Red Riding 1974, the first of the Red Riding trilogy. While I was waiting to go down and do the gig with Ivor a couple of weeks ago, I walked into Reading's bookshop in Port Melbourne and found the Red Riding trilogy going for a cheap price on DVD, so I thought, meant to happen, I'll go and get that. And the first one, yeah, tough stuff, really gritty, tough British crime stuff, and I'm looking forward to watching the other two, but I don't think I can watch them all in one after the other session. I've really got to kind of cleanse my palate in between. But I did see that. The week before, I did a movie for the radio. I watched The Ipcress File with Michael Caine, and we had a good time talking about that on the radio. Roughly about the time we were talking about it, on the recording end of it at least, Sue Lloyd, the actress who's Michael Caine's love interest in The Ipcress File, died. So I'm hoping that this isn't a pattern that forms and that me talking about people on the radio doesn't end up meaning that they're going to croak, though anything's possible. But, yeah, so we did The Ipcress File and enjoyed that. Did a little bit of Eurospy. Did see a cool movie from the early 80s called Privates on Parade, which has Dennis Quilly and John Cleese and a bunch of other people. It's about a song and dance unit attached to the army working in Malaya, as it was then, during the Malaya crisis. And it's got drag queens and drama and comedy and combines a whole bunch of things. Very young Bruce Payne in that, playing one of the soldiers. Bruce Payne, you might remember from any number of 80s and 90s exploitation films. He gets his balls shot off, so at least that's something there. I did see Red State, the Kevin Smith film as well, and Red State, I enjoyed it. It's an interesting film because, now I'm just going to pause and do a cough here, but I'll be back and I'll finish that because it's a kind of mediocre film with two fucking fantastic bits of acting in it. It's an odd beast, this film. Of course, Michael Pugh's being one of it, playing the mad evangelist priest. Fantastic. Michael Parks, superb actor in everything I've ever seen him do, as far back as Then Came Bronson in the 1960s. And yes, I did see that. And also, of course, John Goodman, who has dropped a bit of weight and now looks like a basset hound. But John Goodman really bringing his A game to this one as well. I recommend people see it basically for the acting. The rest of it, it's kind of sets itself up as a bit of a kind of torture porn horror movie, but doesn't really go there. And tonally, there's something wrong with it. I'm not quite sure what it is, But there is something slightly wrong with the tone of the film. But again, I do recommend that you see it for the acting, which is superb. The only other thing I've really seen of much interest, and as I said, real life and renovations have interfered with my movie watching, damn them, is The Trip, the movie which has Rob Brydon and Steve Coogan in it, basically going around trying out posh restaurants and talking to each other. And yeah, that's fun. That's a good bit of comedy. It's a good bit of pseudo-documentary. And yeah, I think it kind of works. It's interesting. And both of them are very interesting guys who I've seen in any number of other things. And I'd like to see more of those kind of... I think it may have been originally for television in the UK, but I'd like to see more of those kind of things. Just interesting people driving around the countryside, eating, booking into hotels, fucking the chick at the desk at the hotel, and having a chat. So that's about all I've been really watching lately. But, yeah, not a bad lot of stuff. I'm still very engaged in watching movies, and the fact that I've got to do it every week for the radio, well, I don't have to, I choose to do it every week for the radio, I should say, means that I've got to kind of do a lot of stuff, thinking up which movie we're going to talk about, how we're going to approach, all that sort of thing. And I love that. I really, really am passionately fond of doing that. It is different from doing it for the podcast, because I can't really say cunt on the radio the way I can on a podcast. And I'm playing off another person a lot more. I think what I may be doing, and this may sound silly or it may sound incredibly sensible, is I'm using the radio as a training ground for me getting more people onto Paleo Cinema Podcast as guests, just learning how to do that back and forth rather than the monologue thing I'm doing now, and really kind of, yeah, using that to enrich this, which, yeah, not a bad thing at all. Anyway, I'm going to take a break now because my throat's a bit odd. I'm going to go and grab an espresso to lubricate it. And when I get back after I play some music, I will talk about something.
The massage parlor hookers are coming.
For the right price, I'll never rub you the wrong way.
Massage parlor hookers, small town girls with big city morals, the anything for a price gals who make your pleasure their business.
I believe in different strokes for different folks.
Massage parlor hookers, they'll take on all comers.
Why don't you come and see us tonight?
Massage parlor hookers in pulsating color, rated R.
Yes, I know that wasn't music, but I thought I'd put it in there anyway. I've decided what I'm going to do with this podcast, surprise, surprise, 12 minutes into it, 13 minutes into it. And what I'm going to do is I'm going to have a brief talk about one movie from every year I have been alive. So 1 to 2 minute talks about a whole bunch of movies, one from 1957 all the way up to 2011. So I'm going to see how this goes. It's a bit of an experiment. I'm probably going to have a break around the 1960s, 1970s, and the 1990s. But it's a bit fun. And hopefully it will work. If it doesn't, there's always another podcast in 2 weeks' time. That's the big thing to remember with these sort of things. Okay, 1957. I'm going to go with the first zombie movie I ever saw, a movie called Zombies of Moratao, which scared the shit out of me when I was a little kid. There's actually a story to this. I was staying at my grandparents' place with my cousin Arthur at the time. And Arthur was a bit older than me, and at the time, and I haven't met him for like 40-odd years, bit of an asshole. And I was very upset at having seen Zombies of Moratao, even though later on I went, oh, that was a cool movie. I was a little kid, and I was a little bit upset. It showed on late-night television. And so they gave me half of a sleeping pill, the way you did your medicated kids to make them calm down in those days. And so I was given half of a sleeping pill by my grandparents. And Arthur and I are both sleeping on camp beds in the kind of off the TV room it was at the time. And just as we're going to sleep, Arthur said to me, you know that if you go to sleep, you'll die if you're taking one of those sleeping pills. There used to be a lot more cousins to this place, and yeah, you know, if you fall asleep, you're going to die. And I was a little kid, I believed stuff like that, and unfortunately Arthur made me believe it. And I spent the whole night fighting off the effects of this fucking sleeping pill, to stay awake, and I might have been like 5 or 6 at the time. So they kept getting cranky with me because I was awake all night and that kind of thing. And eventually I fell asleep, but I was strongly convinced that I wasn't going to wake up, which shows that cousins are assholes. But it did make Zombies of Murata really memorable. It's the Sam Katzman movie. It's a crazy story about zombies protecting a treasure of diamonds in a sunken ship for no good reason. And there's an old lady who lives by herself in a creepy old house on the coast, and her granddaughter or great-granddaughter, it's a bit vague which one it is, comes to visit. And the zombies, who are very slow-looking and kind of look like what they are, which is slightly drunken character actors, protect the diamonds. So it's worth checking out. It's the Sam Katzman movie for Columbia Pictures and a bit loopy. Okay, let's move on to 1958. And that's the year that Dracula, also known as Horrors of Dracula, came out. The Hammer Dracula film, the first in the series of Hammer Dracula films, starring Christopher Lee, Peter Cushing, Michael Goff's in it, Melissa Stribling, John Van Essen, who later became an executive for one of the movie studios as well. And this one was really the movie that sexualized vampires, and in particular Dracula. Of course, they had a little bit of Lugosi being kind of a bit of a heartthrob, but this is the first movie that was a little more blatant in its sexualizing of Dracula, which was a censorship problem, particularly in Australia and places like that. But really, this took vampires to a new level, being below the waist.
This is the story of Dracula, a creature who destroys all he touches. Dracula, the terrifying, the feared, who sleeps in the tombs of the dead by day and arises at night to inflict his terror upon the innocent and the unsuspecting.
You must help me. You must. You're my only hope. You must.
I'll help you.
In 1959, it was the tail end of the biblical epics, and there wasn't one bigger than Ben-Hur. And I do like Ben-Hur for a couple of reasons, none of which really relate to the religion stuff or to Charlton Heston. I like the fact, and it's a dubious fact, Gore Vidal has said this, I like the fact that Stephen Boyd played Masala like he was in love with Ben-Hur. Whether that's real or not, that perception stuck in my head now, and I really like it. And even before I knew that, I wanted Stephen Boyd to win the chariot race. He was a much more vivid and interesting character than Ben-Hur, who suffered a lot and was religious and really kind of gritted his teeth. And yeah, it didn't have enough zing the way that Masala had. And I do believe Stephen Boyd acted Charlton Heston way off the screen on that. The other thing I like about it is an Australian actor who was also in The Man from Hong Kong is in Ben-Hur, being Frank Thring. He's the guy, Pontius Pilate, who does the chariot race. He basically checkered flags the chariot race in Ben-Hur. And Australians love that. Whenever an Australian actor turns up in an old movie, anytime Michael Pate turns up in an old movie, or Rod Taylor, or Guy Dolman, or Chips Rafferty, or anybody like that turns up, we really love it. We really like to see our own people in films. And, Frank Thring is definitely in Ben-Hur. He is also in the wonderful The Vikings, starring Tony Curtis and Kirk Douglas. He's the guy that cuts Tony Curtis's hand off, as Brian Trenchard Smith mentioned in the commentary track to The Man from Hong Kong. So, Ben-Hur is my movie for 1959. Okay, that brings us to 1960. What I'm going to do for 1960 is a movie that's been remade 3 times, sort of, in the 2000s. And that, of course, being the 1960 classic Rat Pack film Ocean's 11, starring Dean Martin, Sammy Davis Jr., Frank Sinatra. It's got Angie Dickinson in it, it's got Richard Conte in it, it's got Henry Silver in it, and it's ring-a-ding-ding. It is really, really cool, even though there is a couple of scenes in here where Sinatra wears some very kind of slightly gay-looking sweaters. But in spite of that, it's a good caper film. It's influenced, of course, by earlier caper films like Rafifi and other things like that, and The Killing. a bunch of other films. And really, it really is just one of those films that you kind of watch thinking, fuck, this is politically incorrect, but I really kind of think that I would have loved to have been one of these guys hanging out in Vegas, shooting craps, singing in nightclubs at night time, sleeping with attractive women, and just in general having a ball. It really is a really big artifact of its time in that sense. It is a fantastic little piece of cinema. It's it was made in a hurry because Sinatra wanted to get back to enjoying himself in Las Vegas. And they drove Lewis Milestone, the director, nuts during the making of this film. Just because they go, okay, one take, that's it. Boom, out of here. I'm off to drink bourbon and hang out with hookers. And, you know, pretty cool stuff. And not much else to say about that. If you haven't seen it, check it out. I'll tell you the story how I got this one. This is one of the movies I got for doing the Loch Ness Monster on the shore of Loch Ness. The Loch Ness Monster for puppetry, the penis that is. I did it on the shore of Loch Ness on a bet with Sal, and I had to get, and I won 5 DVDs, one of which was Ocean's 11. There you go. Okay, let's go to 1961. You remember 1961, it was in all the newspapers. So I'm going to go with one of the big blockbuster war films. I mean, in the early 60s, there were a lot of them coming out, and they were all really gung-ho, fantastic movies, mostly based on novels, because the novels of war heroics were incredibly popular at the time. And this one we've got is The Guns of Navarone, based on a novel by Alistair MacLean. And it's got a good ensemble cast. It's got Gregory Peck, David Niven. It has Anthony Quinn in it. It's got basically lots of really nasty anonymous Germans and a plan to blow up 2 enormous cannons on the island of Navarone, which are blocking the Allies' shipping from getting through and letting them resupply their forces around the Mediterranean. This one is really great. It's got a fantastic explosion at the end. It's got some good spy stuff in it. The book's actually quite readable too. I read the book a few years ago, so I definitely recommend that you do that as well. And it's just one of those movies like The Great Escape and war films of that ilk that really kind of populated my childhood in a sense. They turn up every now and then on Sunday afternoons back in the days before you could choose which movies you saw, and you were kind of stuck with what was on television. And these were the films that I grew up with for that reason. The past really sucked as far as access to media is concerned, but now and then you get these nice films that turned up. And I remember wishing at the time there was a way I could keep a copy of them, and now of course I've got them all on DVD and really do appreciate them, and Guns of Navarone's definitely in there. It's not a film you can watch all the time, but now and then it's nice to kind of dip into these kind of heroics and just kind of enjoy them for what they are and see how people making these films overcame the limitations of technology. There are some great model work in this film. There's some good bat paintings and a few other bits and pieces, and it's really, really worth your time to check out The Guns of Navarone. Okay, 1962, which was the year that gave us, amongst other things, Jim Carrey, Adam Baldwin, Matthew Broderick, Tom Cruise, Steve Carell, Joan Cusack, Jodie Foster, Ralph Fiennes, Demi Moore, Baz Luhrmann, and a bunch of other people as well. But in the cinema, it gave us a ton of cool stuff. In fact, too much to talk about. I'm just going to talk about the year. Advice and Consent, which I've talked about in the podcast, it gave us that one. It gave us Birdmen of Alcatraz with Burt Lancaster, Cape Fear, the original one, The Day of the Triffids, the original movie, Dr. No, the first Sean Connery James Bond film. It gave us that. It gave us Exterminating Angel by Buñuel. It gave us La Dolce Vita, I think. But let me check that out. No, it didn't. That was a year before. It gave us Lawrence of Arabia, Lolita, Lonelier the Brave. It gave us The Manchurian Candidate, The Music Man. Panic in Year Zero, I've talked about that one on the podcast. Requiem for Heavyweight, the movie starring Anthony Quinn and Jackie Gleason. Gave us that one as well. That was just a killer year for things. And I really can't pick out one for this year because it's just such a cool year for cinema. Wonderful World of the Brothers Grimm, which I've kind of liked too. Whatever Happened to Baby Jane with Bette Davis and Joan Crawford ripping each other's faces off. 1962, if you don't like a movie from the year 1962, what the fuck are you doing listening to a podcast? It really was kind of milestone in a lot of ways. It doesn't always get mentioned as that, but just looking over the stuff that it's got, wow, is all I can say about 1962. 1963 had some interesting choices as well, but there's one that kind of stood out for me as the film I'm going to talk about for 1963. It's a mad world, a Stanley Kramer produced and directed film, which has an ensemble cast of comedians that is unequaled in cinema history, really. Just off the top of it, this is just the main characters. You've got Spencer Tracy in a comedy role. You've got Milton Berle, Sid Caesar, Jonathan Winters, Mickey Rooney, Buddy Hackett, Buster Keaton, Jimmy Durante, Terry Thomas, Phil Silvers, Dick Shawn, Edie Adams, Paul Fort, Ethel Merman, Dorothy Provine. And not only do you have that, these actors coming together, you have it as a road movie. They're all chasing after a treasure in San Diego, a criminal guy drives off the road and he's dying. He's played by Jimmy Durante, and he tells these five people who stopped to see the crash and to try to help out that there's $350,000 buried in Santa Rosa Park near the Mexican border under a big W. And everybody just kind of goes greedy. This movie is not only just a terrific action film with some fantastic stunt sequences and every possible permutation of what you can do, what can go wrong when you're driving fast in a car and an aeroplane and other things as well. It's really a crazy criticism of greed in America at the time. And I think that was slid under the radar a lot. It really did have a lot to say about that, and also about how with the Spencer Tracy character, how hard-working public servants are fucked over by the system. And you know, you can actually see more in this film than is actually on the very wonderful, fast-paced, hilarious surface of it. It's really it's in my collection. I'm really going to have to watch this film again. I haven't watched it in a while, but I just love it because it does have an unexpected little bit of depth to it. So that's it for 1963. It's a mad world. 1964 brought us a few people as well. Let's see who was born then. Nicolas Cage, Matt Dillon, Chris Farley, Laura Linney, Bridget Fonda, Russell Crowe for some reason, Courtney Cox, Sandra Bullock, Keanu Reeves, and for some odd reason, Terry Hatcher. But I was going to talk about the movie that I like most from 1964, being Jacques Demy's The Umbrellas of Cherbourg, but I'm not going to because I've already talked about that in a podcast, and this time around I'm not talking about movies I've done previously in a podcast. So I've got to choose one. There's a lot to choose from in 1964 as well. Seven Faces of Dr. Low. You've got Blood and Black Lace by Mario Bava was 64. Cracking the World, starring Dana Andrews, Dr. Strangelove, Failsafe, Fall of the Roman Empire, A Fistful of Dollars came out in 1964, Goldfinger, of course, this is the peak of Bond mania, the 64-65 time, Invitation to a Gunfight with Yul Brynner, which is pretty cool, Kitten with a Whip, starring Anne Margaret, which I do recommend, Marriage Italian Style by Vittorio De Sica, starring Sofia Loren and Marcello Mastroianni. Very cool. The Mask of the Red Death with Vincent Price. Mothra vs. Godzilla, The Naked Kiss came out in that year. Paris When It Sizzles, which I've got a lot of fondness for. You should go back and listen to the podcast where I did Paris When It Sizzles. Very cool movie. And The Pleasure Seekers, starring Anne Margaret again, which is kind of a remake of Three Coins in a Fountain with Capri Pants. Robinson Crusoe on Mars, Robin and the Seven Hoods. Movie 7 Days in May by Frankenheimer. I just picked up a movie poster, an original Daybill movie poster of 7 Days in May. So I do recommend that. Seance on a Wet Afternoon with Kim Stanley and Richard Attenborough. Another fine film. L'Homme de Rio, which I talked about in a podcast. Top Carpi, which I've talked about in a podcast. I don't think there's a year around this time. Zulu and Zorba the Greek, both. So I haven't really picked a movie from 1964. Basically, what I can say is pick a movie from 1964. You can't go wrong unless it's one of the Elvis Presley musicals. Just to digress for a moment, sorry if there's a bit of background noise at the moment. It's raining pretty heavily outside, and I've got the window open. So that isn't static. That is the sounds of nature you're hearing. So let's head into 1965. I've got a couple of choices on this one too, but I'll talk about a couple of films. The first one, of course, being 36 Hours, starring James Garner, Rod Taylor and Eva Marie Saint. It's a black and white film. Turns up on TCM a lot here in Australia. And basically, James Garner plays an Allied intelligence officer during World War II who's captured by the Germans, and they set up a camp to convince him that the war is over and that it's actually 1946 or 1947 or somewhere along there, and the Allies have won the war, and try to get him to divulge where the Allied invasions are going to occur on D-Day. It's based on an idea by Roald Dahl, famous for, of course, Charlie and the Chocolate Factory, amongst other things. And it's quite a cool little movie. It's not a big film in that sense, but it's a very taut little thriller, and I recommend it as well. The other movie I'm going to talk about is probably, let's scroll down the list because there are a number of them as well. I could talk about Cat Ballou or Dr. Zhivago or Faster Pussycat Kill Kill came out in 65 as well. Help, the Beatles movie directed by Richard Lester. What else would I talk about? Pierre Le Fou, yeah, Jean-Luc Godard with Jean-Paul Belmondo and Anna Karenina. I recommend that film as well because apart from anything else, it does have a couple of scenes with Samuel Fuller in them, which is to be recommended. It's a little bit of French New Wave fluff in a sense, but it does have a lot of style to it, and Belmondo and Anna Karenina do very well together. Of course, she had a long-term relationship with Jean-Luc Godard as well. But that one, in beautiful colour, is recommended. What else came out in the year? Planet of the Vampires, Barber. Terrific one, very influential film, that influenced movies like Alien, amongst others. Sands of the Kalahari, I've talked about in a podcast. Really, really fine action film, which fortunately no asshole has tried to remake since. But 1965, well worth checking out. Let's see who was born in that year. Jolly Richardson, Alan Cumming was born in that year. Kristen Davis, Sarah Jessica Parker was born in a stable somewhere. Robert Downey Jr., Ileana Douglas, Jeremy Piven, he of the weird hairline. Charlie Sheen was born in that year, and Ben Stiller. So basically a good combination of cool people and assholes, really. So, what do we get on to next? 1966. I hope this isn't boring, people. If it is, I'm going to be devastated. And on that note, it's probably time to have a music break. So I'm going to have a music break and then head on to 1966. As you might have guessed by now, I'm not going to get through every year subsequent to that. I'm going to stop somewhere along the line when I get a bit fed up with it or when I hit a wall. But let's get a bit of music in the meantime. That was Ennio Morricone's theme music to a very bad Richard Burton film called Bluebeard, which was only brightened up by the fact that there is some female nudity in it. But it's a very fine Morricone soundtrack. I do like that one a lot. I've listened to most of the tracks on it. And if you can find a copy of that, I do recommend it. Really a classic piece of Morricone. Even though he does seem to use kazoos in it just a little bit. 1966, which was the year that my father got custody of me and my brother from my mother, and we started going to movies, lunchtimes on Saturdays, because he wanted to go to the pub, so we got shipped off to watch double features down at the Regal Cinema in Liverpool, New South Wales. And this was a pretty good year for movies, really. Let's have a look at what we've got. Alvarez Kelly with William Holden, which I actually saw at that cinema. Well, not in that year, but during that year. The Batman movie starring Adam West and Burt Ward was 1966, which is pretty good. Antonioni's Blow Up, which I keep watching because it fascinates me, even though I don't quite get it. I do watch it every now and then. A movie I saw bits of today, actually, Carry On Screaming. One of the Carry On movies. Cul-de-sac, directed by Polanski, starring Donald Pleasence and Francois Dorliac. I recommend that one. Dead Heat on a Merry-Go-Round, starring James Coburn. I'm trying to find a copy of this movie at the moment. Haven't really had much luck yet, but it is one of the ones that I do want to get a copy of, because apart from anything else, Harrison Ford appears in it, believe it or not. He appeared as a bellhop in Dead Heat on a Merry-Go-Round, starring James Coburn. Fahrenheit 451, I've talked about that in the podcast. Funeral in Berlin, the second one of the Harry Palmer films, first one being The Ipcress Fire from 65. A funny thing happened on the way to the Forum, which is a weird movie. It stars Zero Mostel, Phil Silvers, a few other people. Directed by Richard Lester, it was based on a Sondheim musical, and they took pretty much all of the songs out of the film except for the title song, which is a shame because there's some great songs in that film. It's in that play, but yeah, really a weird choice by the people making the film. Let's have a look at what else we've got here. Harper with Paul Newman. I don't know. I may have talked about that in a podcast. I do like it. It's kind of a rejigged detective movie, private eye movie. It's got kind of 40s sensibilities in some ways and 60s sensibilities in others. And good cast: Paul Newman, Robert Wagner, Lauren Bacall, Julie Harris, Janet Leigh. One of the early scripts written by William Goldman, that one. And definitely a cool thing. The Naked Prey, I've talked about that one in the podcast as well. Starring Cornell Wilde. Our Man Flint with James Coburn. Very, very, very cool. The Professional, starring Lee Marvin, Burt Lancaster, Jack Palance and Claudia Cardinale. If you haven't seen that one, it's got an incredibly cool scene where Burt Lancaster's got some sweating dynamite in his hand, and the sweating dynamite's very unstable, so he runs his finger along and takes some of the sweat off the dynamite and just flicks it against a wall and snaps a paling on the wall of a shed. So, yeah, a cool movie. Sand Pebbles with Steve McQueen. And Guilty Pleasures, The Silencers, starring Dean Martin, one of the Matt Helm films, was from 1966 as well. They're a Weird Mob, an Australian film by Powell and Pressburger, but made in Australia about an Italian guy who migrates to Australia, played by Walter Chiari, who for a time was Ava Gardner's boyfriend. Yeah, it's very kind of stereotyped Australians in that film, but it was one of the first big films to be made in Australia at the time, and it made a big fuss. It was made a big fuss of by Australians at the time. So that's pretty much it for 1966. There's a few things there I really have to revisit. It's a cool year for film. And Morgan, A Suitable Case for Treatment, with David Warner's in that one, and Vanessa Redgrave. I have to revisit that film again. some stage. I remember being highly influenced by it at an early age. I think I saw it on late night television and I thought it was the coolest thing imaginable at the time. Probably be disappointed when I watch it again, but I'll be very nostalgic when I do. So that's 1966. I'd like to say that 67 was a cool year, but I just checked it out and the highest grossing film of 1967, and I say this with not too much pleasure, was Disney's The Jungle Book, which disappoints me because that year had movies like Bonnie and Clyde, The Dirty Dozen, You Only Live Twice, and a bunch of other cool films in it, Barefoot in the Park with Robert Redford and Jane Fonda, which I kind of like, and my favourite film about golf, Banning, which I talked about in a podcast with Dr. Zom. Bedazzled came out in that year as well. Billion Dollar Brain, directed by Ken Russell. The third Harry Palmer film came out then. Let's have a look at what else we've got. Camelot, which I kind of like the musical of Camelot because I find Vanessa Redgrave very sexy in it, and I think that Richard Harris does a nice little bit of acting as King Arthur, so I do like it, that one. I don't like all the songs in it, but I think it's a bold attempt, which really kind of gives it some redeeming qualities as far as I'm concerned. Good, the Bad and the Ugly was released in America in 1967 as well, so it was made a little bit earlier. Hombre, starring Paul Newman, Frederick March, Diane Cilento, and Richard Boone. Any movie with Richard Boone. Hotel with Rod Taylor, the one I did again with Dr. Zom. Very cool film, that one. Mad Monster Party, the Rankin Bass animated film, was made in 67, which is very, very cool. Privilege, with Peter Watkins' film, starring Paul Jones and Gene Shrimpton, which is one of the best bits of science fiction of the 1960s, and is in a book I've got called Popcorn, 50 Years of Rock and Roll Movies by Gary Mulholland. Gary Mulholland has said that this is the best rock and roll film of all time, Privilege. I did talk about it in a podcast, but if you haven't seen that film, I recommend that you acquire a copy of it. It may have had a Criterion edition. But Privilege is basically about Stephen Shorter, a pop star who's incredibly, he's bigger than the Beatles, and he becomes manipulated by a kind of fascist regime in the UK in the future into being used as a kind of population control mechanism. They manipulate him to manipulate the public, and it's a savage satire. Paul Jones and Gene Shrimpton aren't particularly good actors, but in this film they don't need to be. They really kind of can lowball it, and it's one of those ones again that I saw at a kind of vulnerable age, and that had an undue influence on me. I've got the soundtrack album to it as well, by the way. There's a non-Man from U.N.C.L.E. spy movie called The Venetian Affair with Robert Vaughn in it from 1967, which I kind of like. It's got Boris Karloff in it as well, and Elka Summers in it, and Felicia Farr. It's a kind of very dark spy movie, and a little bit unexpected from people who were expecting Robert Vaughn to do a Man from U.N.C.L.E. kind of thing at the time. So that's another recommendation. And, of course, my other favourite Jacques Demy musical, The Young Girls of Rochefort, which I recently talked about on the radio, is a film of 1967. And it just has one of the most joyous soundtracks ever. It's a fantastic soundtrack. And, of course, 1967 should be remembered because it's the year that gave us Philip Seymour Hoffman, Liev Schreiber, Guy Pearce, Mark Ruffalo. Let's see who else was born in that year. Nicole Kidman, but we'll forgive him that. Emily Watson, Laura Dern, Benicio del Toro was born in 1967 as well. So who died in? Let's have a look at who died in 1967, because that's always an interesting thing to do. Vivian Leigh died. Francoise Dorliac, the actress who was in The Young Girls of Rochefort, the sister of Catherine Deneuve, died in a very nasty car accident in 1967. I've read up about that car accident, and it's really, really horrifying. And if you enjoyed The Young Girls of Rochefort at all, and I know, Morris, you've recently acquired a copy of it, don't look up the way that Francois Dorliac died. Just not very, very pleasant at all. So 1967, quite an interesting year. I think The President's Analyst came out in 67 as well, another groovy movie starring James Coburn. Just made an executive decision that I'm going to take today's podcast up to about 1975. I won't go any further than that and won't inflict my dulcet tones on you any more than that regarding cinema. So we'll get on to 1968. 1968 is the year of my favourite Charlton Heston film. Now, I'm not particularly fond of Charlton Heston, even though I've met him, but there is one film of his that I find really, really moving and touching, and I think that Charlton Heston in this film really does earn his money. And that film is a Western directed by Tom Grice called Will Penny, which I recommend that people see. It's a fine Western. It's a very atypical one. Heston himself has said it's the favourite film in which he appeared. It's got a pretty good cast. Joan Hackett's in it and Donald Pleasence is in it as well. It really is a kind of slow-paced mood piece, which, as you can hear in the background, has a very fine soundtrack by my favourite movie composer of all time, David Raxon, which really adds to the mood of the film. Ben Johnson's in it as well. Lee Majors is in it. I've forgotten that Lee Majors is in this film. Bruce Stern's in it. Slim Pickens. Matt Clark. I don't watch this movie very often because I always cry at the end of it. It really does choke me up. And I never expected to have a Western affect me that way. Really, this one is one that I'm going to have to podcast about at some stage. When I get down to the W's of the A to Z project, I think I'll pencil this one in because I really do want to kind of re-watch it and kind of enjoy it again. Because it does have such a profound emotional effect on me, this film, I really do want to not watch it too often. I'd hate for it to lose that for me, which is a lovely place to be with a film, really. Knowing that it gives you an emotional impact and treasuring it, but holding off from it a little bit, not going there too often. I have the same reaction to The Umbrellas of Cherbourg, and oddly enough, I had the reaction the couple of times that I saw Brando's Last Tango in Paris as well. So yeah, the movie for 1968 is definitely Will Penny, and if you have not seen it, you're in for a treat. But be prepared, even if you're a tough bastard like me, to bring some tissues with you. 1969 was... There's only one movie you can do for 1969, really, and that's Dennis Hopper's Easy Rider. I've got a problem with this film for one reason, which is totally silly and totally selfish and very personal. I think anybody who drops acid in a graveyard in New Orleans is fucking mental, really. You're not going to have a good trip in a cemetery anywhere. And I've got a little bit of experience in this. But particularly in New Orleans, no, it's just something you don't do. You've got to be in a safe place when you drop acid. It's part of the prerequisites for doing the drug safely. So indulged a little bit myself, I really kind of had a problem with Easy Rider for that. But having said that, it was a profound movie in the sense that it had an enormous effect on a lot of people at the time. I even had the poster on the wall of the two bikes, a big black and white poster on my wall. I had two posters. I had The Beast from The Beast from 20,000 Fathoms, and I had the Easy Rider poster of the two motorbikes, a black and white poster. And when I eventually saw the film, yeah, I could see that Jack Nicholson's speech about freedom, the beautiful countryside, and the kind of road trip feel about it. The roads in American films at the time were always associated with freedom. Vanishing Point, Two Lane Blacktop, Easy Rider, road movies won it all. People who weren't tied down to a job and a mortgage, as I unfortunately am, though I can't see the advantages of it these days. And the personable characters in it, Billy and Captain America and Jack Nicholson's character. Just an interesting and a very seminal film. Okay, so now we get to 1970, and you're starting to phase into your blaxploitation era at the time. And one of the first blaxploitation films, a very interesting one at that, was a film called Cotton Comes to Harlem, which was based on novels by Chester Himes starring two New York cops called Coffinhead and Gravedigger, who were really hardcore cops. They were kick asses and take names. And this movie, directed by the actor Ossie Davis, is really fun. It's full on. It's got an authentic black urban voice to it. And it really does kick ass, and it was a very influential in blaxploitation. It showed that people did want to see films by black people and for a general audience, but showing their point of view. Later on, the studios really kind of came on with more films like Shaft and Superfly. There was a sequel to Cotton Comes to Harlem 2, a movie called Come Back Charleston Blue, again with Godfrey Cambridge and Romy St. Jacques in it, based again on a Chester Himes novel. Haven't seen that one in a very long time, but I do have a copy of Cotton Comes to Harlem, which I like. There are some great car chases where, you know, carts go flying and chickens go flying and all sorts of things like that. And really, this, if you want to kind of find your origins of blaxploitation film, there are a few films like this and Sweetback's Badass Song and a few other ones that really do show the leading edge of blaxploitation. So if you haven't seen this film, it's around. It's been available on DVD for a while as well. And yeah, check it out. It is a cool piece of cinema. And it's nice to see where things come from.
Name? Kowalski. Occupation? Driver. Transporting a supercharged Dodge Challenger from Denver to San Francisco. Background? Medal of Honor in Vietnam. Former stock and bike racer. Former cop. Dishonorably discharged. Now he uses speed to get himself up. To get himself gone. Everybody's after Kowalski.
Because you think we're queers.
For one reason or another.
Is there something I can do for you?
Well, like what?
Like anything you want.
Everybody wants a piece of his hide.
Maybe kill somebody. Maybe stole that big dude of his. Maybe move.
Look at that son of a...
They want to get him and put him away.
1971, you can't go past Rich Serapion's Vanishing Point. You got a big muscle car Dodge Challenger, you got Barry Newman, you've got Open Highways, you've got Cleavon Little as Super Soul, the DJ who's narrating what Kowalski's doing going from Denver, Colorado to San Francisco as fast as he can in this car, with the cops chasing him, bulldozers, a news truck. Basically, this is the perfect drive-in movie. And, well, I know 35 different perfect drive-in movies, but this is one of them. This is in the genre of two-lane blacktop and Dirty Mary, Crazy Larry. It's just such a part of its time. And I have a lot of time for Death Proof, to the Tarantino movie, which is kind of based on this. And just the coolness of Kowalski, even though he's hyped up on speed, just racing the car through the desert, through the countryside. The other film to see with Barry Newman and a car in it, of course, is Fear is the Key, based on the Alistair MacLean novel. There's a scene at the start of that with a car chase, which is mind-blowingly good. Car chases where they're not done with the CGI are extremely cool. No arguments. If they're done well, you can enjoy the hell out of them. And I was talking with Ivor about The Man from Hong Kong, we were talking about the car chases in that and how good they were. They were set up on a low budget and very quickly, and with a whole bunch of cowboys, car stunt people, one of whom had worked, I think, with Equipage Remy Julien in France. And they're just cool films. And Vanishing Point is right up there near the top of cool car films.
Shores of the Antipodes, wafting the scent of the eucalypt trees. If you wanna get your sister in a frenzy, take your sister in a frenzy.
Now we hit Ozploitation and The Adventures of Barry McKenzie. The great thing I like about this film is that when I first saw it, I didn't really understand it as satire. I understood flattening palms, and I understood drinking, and I understood vomiting, and I understood attractive naked women. But I didn't understand that Barry Humphries, who wrote the original comic strip for Private Eye in the 1960s, was satirizing Australian culture and the way Australians perceive themselves, particularly while they were overseas in the UK. I had no understanding of this at all at the time. I really, really was pig ignorant about this film. But having seen it recently, I really kind of like the fact that England is portrayed as a shithole, apart from anything else. It's got dog shit on the footpaths. It's a nasty place. Everybody there is a kind of Edwardian slum dweller who's incredibly greedy and nasty, or else they're toffee-nosed twits. And I really like that. I love the fact that every single person in the film, including Barry McKenzie, is a caricature and has the piss taken out of them big time. There was a sequel a couple of years later called Barry McKenzie Holds His Own, which is great because it's got Donald Pleasence in it playing a vampire called Count Plasma. And of course we have Barry Humphries in this film as well, playing Edna Everidge, now Dame Edna Everidge. And it has a whole bunch of other character actors in it. It's got people like Peter Cook in it, for instance. It's got a whole bunch of Australian expatriate actors in it. The sequel has people like Clive James in it, but really, I had no idea if this was actually a satire at the time. Even though I had seen Barry Humphries' stage shows, it totally eluded me. And this film reminds me how ignorant I once was about a lot of things.
It was upon a Lammas night when corn rigs are bonny. Beneath the moon's unclouded light, I held a while to Annie. The time went by with careless heed till tween the late and early. With small persuasion she agreed to see me through the barley.
The Wicker Man is one of the great horror films of all time. I'm not talking a Nick Cage version, I'm talking Edward Woodward, I'm talking Christopher Lee, I'm talking Britt Eklund and Diane Cilento and Ingrid Pitt and all the rest of them. It really is a great story, apart from anything else. And the policeman in the story, from my point of view, is such a repugnant character that even though he has a terrible, horrible death, I can kind of see their point, which makes me somewhat sick, I suppose. But really, Neil Howie, the character, is such a tight ass and really so locked into his own world that when he eventually is revealed to him what's going on and why it's going on, you really don't have a lot of sympathy for him. And that's an interesting arc for a horror movie to take. The protagonist usually doesn't, at least up until this point, have that kind of a problem. And of course the music, as you can hear by Paul Giovanni, is fantastic all the way through the film. The world of Summer Isle is built up beautifully in this film by Robin Hardy, the director, and it's just a weird and off-kilter but oddly realistic horror film. I saw it first at the State Theatre in Sydney. It was showing with a 1970s titty film, and I got blown away by I got sucked in by the story and blown away by the climax, and it's still one of my favourite horror films of all time. 1974, and I thought I'd do an interesting film called Emmanuel. It's a French film. It's directed by Jules Chaykin and starring Sylvia Christel and Alain Cuny, who people might remember from La Dolce Vita. He played the guy who committed suicide in La Dolce Vita. And yeah, it's a softcore porn film set in Thailand. A French diplomat's wife has a sexual adventures in Thailand. It's all incredibly tasteful and beautifully filmed, and the women are beautiful and the locations are beautiful, and it creates this sex-drenched world which really is an interesting kind of thing to do. There were any number of porn films, including hardcore porn films, before this one, but this was the first one that really kind of decided to go classy and French. Now, the French at the time were starting to come into the phase when companies like Alpha France started making hardcore films. But Emmanuel and the early Emmanuel series were very tasteful and lovely. They were on locations, they had reasonable budgets, they had name actors in them to some extent, and just really did create a subgenre of their own, which was a little bit interesting. Very popular in Japan, apart from anything else, this film, and it became very popular in Australia as well. I was a young guy at the time, and really, basically this film blew me away a little bit at the time. I really had an urge to visit the tropics, but I didn't have the budget to do so, and it's just a fine piece of filmmaking while being totally and utterly involved in sex. Sylvia Christel, unfortunately, did have some drug addictions later in life, and her career didn't go anywhere near where it could have. But at the time, she was beautiful. The other women in the film are beautiful. The guys are all a little bit of assholes. But again, this is very much an artifact of its time. And if you're interested in that sort of thing, I definitely recommend that you check it out. And finally, we get to 1975, and a very fine film noir of the period, starring Gene Hackman, Jennifer Warren, Susan Clarke. It's Night Moves, directed by Arthur Penn. Gene Hackman plays a character called Harry Mosby, a private investigator. He's a retired football player. He's got a really bad relationship with his wife, and he needs to track down a teenager in Florida. The teenager in this case is played by Melanie Griffith, who was very, very young at the time. And this is a great film. It's beautifully put together. The mystery reveals itself really well, and it has a kick-ass climax as well, which is a little bit nihilistic and negative, but it does work incredibly well in context. And I find this one of Gene Hackman's best roles. Really is worth seeing if you haven't already. Has one of James Wood's first roles in it as well, which is interesting. And really, it kind of has that morally bankrupt, degenerate, manipulative, dark film noir essence in a bright location. It just is a fine piece of cinema, and if you don't know it, you should. I'm going to have to do this for a podcast at some stage and kind of elucidate a bit more on this film, because I do find it really interesting. Again, it's one of those films that I don't visit very often because I don't want to lose the reveal. And I know how it ends, of course, but I do like to have it unroll without me remembering too much about it, which is kind of cool. So that's it for this one, the last film of these. This little experiment is 1975's Night Moves. Okay, I'm going to take a little bit of a break now. It's now well after midnight here, and this took longer than I expected it to be honest with you. All of that was just kind of improvised and free association, and I grabbed the bits of music and the audio on the fly with it. So it was I kind of liked the fact that I didn't experiment with this one. I'm not sure how successful it was, and please give me feedback one way or the other. I'm happy for you to do that. But, it was an interesting little thing to do. So I'll be taking a break now, and actually I'll be going to sleep and then coming back and doing this tomorrow morning. But I'll come back with the feedback, and we'll wrap this little puppy, this little Frankenstein of a puppy up. Okay, let's move on to some feedback. And the first feedback I've got is from our mate Morris from Love That Album podcast. And here it is.
Hello, Terry. This is Morris Pishtinsky calling here. Well, not calling. I'm actually doing an MP3 of my voice. As per your recommendation, why should I be calling an American phone number from Melbourne to your place of residence in Melbourne? Doesn't make much sense, does it? So I thought, as per your suggestion, I'd record my voice here on this computer and email it to you with a few movie-related thoughts. Just listen to episode 87, your episode featuring Johnny Guitar and Jour de Fête. First of all, my confession with regards to Jacques Tati films. I'd actually been to see Mon Oncle many years ago at the Astor Cinema, and I'd taken my then 4-year-old son to see the film, and I don't think it agreed with him. I don't think I'd ever walked out on a film before then, and certainly that wasn't one I wanted to walk out on, but poor Max was just not enjoying it. However, he's made up with many fine film choices since then. So I might actually have to reintroduce him to the concept of watching a Jacques Tati film. And I think he's even indicated as such he'll give it another go. Johnny Guitar, another film I haven't seen. I'm very interested in this whole concept of House Un-American Activities with regards to filming, and I think I've gone and made mention on your Facebook page recently about my favourite quote from the Woody Allen film, or the Woody Allen acting vehicle anyway, The Front, made in the mid-1970s, and that was all about him playing as a beard, as a front for a blacklisted screenwriter. And it seems what you had there with Johnny Guitar, both behind the scenes with a front script writer taking credit for a blacklisted screenwriter. So it seems like the Woody Allen film was spot on the money. That was something that actually really happened. I found the whole concept of the McCarthy era disgusting and shocking, but quite fascinating nevertheless. My sister, who was an English teacher for many years, had told me that The Front was pretty much a modern-day version of Arthur Miller's The Crucible, which I hadn't read at the time, but since followed up on. And, the whole concept, shocking, but fascinating nevertheless. I thought also the other thing I wanted to make comment on, Dr. Zom had gone and made the question of you, of what other films you enjoyed that had nuns featured in them. And not sure whether it's a film you enjoy or not, but a very obvious choice I would have thought would have been The Blues Brothers, Kathleen Freeman as the penguin, the nun. And as we all know, you can't lie to a nun. Yeah, very good. A very good, very funny choice, I would have thought. Yep, nevertheless. And final thing I wanted to just make a quick mention of was a film I'd just caught up with in the last couple of days. A film I'd watched many years ago on television, went in Australia, I think, under a different name. It was then called Call Me Genius, but I think its original British title was The Rebel. And it's a film that's starring the great British comedian Tony Hancock. And I'm embarrassed to say I've not actually seen any of Hancock's half hour, but Call Me Genius or The Rebel was something that I watched every year when Channel 9 broadcast it. And it hasn't been on TV, to the best of my knowledge anyway, in quite a long time. But it seems that there's a lot of films that you can find out there on YouTube showing in multiple parts, and failing that I couldn't seem to get hold of the DVD. I went to YouTube and watched the film, and I was a little bit nervous, thinking, I wonder if it's going to be quite as enjoyable as I remembered it. And I needn't have worried. In fact, probably in some ways, now that I'm older, I appreciate it a whole lot more. For those of you who haven't seen it, Hancock is a 9-to-5 office staff member, and he catches the same train every morning and reads the same paper and dresses up in the same suit and bowler hat as hundreds of other men. And he's sick and tired of uniformity. And he has this creative streak in him, which he wants to pursue. So after an embarrassing dismissal from his place of employment, he decides, right, he's going to go out and become a full-time artist, and he's going to go find inspiration by living in Paris, the Paris of the early 1960s. And it's there, of course, we discover, in fact, that his artwork, his painting is shit, basically. He falls in with the arty crowd, the bohemian art crowd. And in a case of The King's New Clothing, his crappy art is seen as being underappreciated genius, and the bohemian crowd absolutely lap him up, and he's willing to take all appreciation that he can get. One very funny scene at a party that he attends, where he's telling the story about how he was 9-to-5, he used to be a 9-to-5 office worker in England, and he couldn't stand wearing a uniform just like everywhere else. And a whole bunch of beatnik-looking bohemians, all the males with goatee beards, and all the women look pretty dating, pale-faced gothic looks, all said, "That's shocking. You'd never catch me looking the same as anyone else. I can't believe it, that people would wear a uniform and all these people look the same." It was quite funny. The film, it's a bit of a story of the King's New Clothes, a bit of a story of pursuing what it is that you really want out of life. But I think, really it's more, of a statement on people blindly following the trends. And, where the film goes, another artist who he is sharing accommodation with, his fine artwork is taken to be the work of Tony Hancock, whose character in the film is also named Anthony Hancock. Anthony basically has to assume credit for his friend's fine artwork, and he gets to be the toast of the art world. So basically it's the King's New Clothes first in the bohemian world, and then he gets to be the toast of the high art-paying aristocracy. There's a lot to be said in this film, and it's quite funny, with a lot of stuff to say about our hypocrisies and how we don't really tend to take things at their own worth, and we just sort of tend to look to others for what our opinions should be. I think I've garbled on long enough. Still really, really loving listening to Paleo Cinema, Terry. Always good food for thought. And, yeah, I'm looking forward to my DVD arriving of The Young Girls of Roquefort. Thanks for the recommendation. And I hope to speak to you again real soon. Cheers.
Thanks for that, Morris. I actually watched The Rebel after you sent me this voicemail, and it is interesting. It's got a great cast, too. Apart from Tony Hancock, it's got George Sanders in it, for instance. Paul Massey, who people might remember from the Hammer Dr. Jekyll movie in the early 60s. Dennis Price is in it, playing an avant-garde artist called Jim Smith. Irene Handel as Mrs. Cravat. Who has some great scenes with Tony Hancock in it. There's even a tiny little cameo as an artist by Oliver Reed in this one. So, yeah, I recommend people do watch that movie because it is a bit of fun. Hancock himself is quite a tragic figure in the British comedy scene. He did have a problem with booze, and he also had a problem with his ego. So, there were some problems there, and he died in my home city. He committed suicide in Sydney. I remember at the time, it was about 68. I remember even as a child that it was in all the newspapers, and there were lots of photos of an apartment building in Bellevue Hill and all those sorts of things, the way the media does tend to suck up to celebrity suicide. But leaving that aside, yep, definitely recommended. The Front I'm going to have to revisit again because I haven't seen that in a very long time, but I'll put it on the list to take a look at. And enjoy. Now, as far as the Blues Brothers and Nuns, I'll be honest with you, I find nuns quite icky, and particularly Catholic nuns with rulers. So Kathleen Freeman, fantastic comic actress. She did a lot of the early solo Jerry Lewis movies, for instance, and was part of his ensemble cast for those things. And yeah, but now nuns are just weird and morbid in my view. I know that a number of real-life nuns tend to do very good works, which, from my belief system, I think they could do without the religious trappings. But anyway, yeah, I think we'll get off the subject of nuns now. I do have another voicemail from our regular correspondent in the hills of West Virginia. Of course, that's Dr. Zom. And here's the man.
Tyrannosaurus Frost. This is Dr. Tom. Oh, Terry, I understand that you're going through some growing pains with some renovations to your humble abode. I wish you and your fine lady friend and also your small furry creatures good luck. It can be a very, very traumatizing experience. But, alas, Frost Giant, I call for not bidding a good day or a good do or a Godot, although I am waiting for Godot at this moment. Where is he, by the way? I called you to speak about a movie called Ryan's Daughter. Specifically about two of the stars, Ryan's Daughter. Those stars are Sarah Miles and the young Christopher Jones. Mr. Frost, you have the knowledge, you have the insight, and you have a very hairy beard. But Mr. Frost, I would like to know what you think of this movie, what you think of those two young stars in their heyday. And also the enigmatic, charismatic, systematic, and hydromatic Trevor Howard. I found this sitting on my shelf gathering dust as I watched the documentary Stevie about a wayward boy who becomes not a good person. But, alas, I digress. A film of stately grandeur and visual splendor. Ryan's Daughter. Talk amongst yourselves. What do you think of this movie? This is Dr. Zom, and I have to let you go for now, because I know that there are probably contractors and men at work, sweating muscular men, supple men, tearing your house to pieces and building it into the castle, the palace, the chalice that you deserve. This is Dr. Zom, calling from the soon-to-be snow-covered mountains of West Virginia, saying so long and good day to you, Mr. Rust.
Shit, we didn't get a raspberry at the end of that one. Yes, thanks, Tom. Ryan's Daughter, I recommend that the soundtrack music is fantastic to it as well, and it does have our old friend Robert Mitchum in a very atypical role. But, yeah, Ryan's Daughter, if you're into the cinema of David Lean, Ryan's Daughter is definitely one to check out. It's one of his big films. After I talked about Bridge on the River Kwai on the radio, and one of the things I found out about it is that David Lean only did six films, including Bridge on the River Kwai, over a 30-odd year period, and all of them were enormous. Before Bridge on the River Kwai, his films were small in scale, but very high in quality. Later on, he went enormous, and Ryan's Daughter does have that kind of enormous feel about it. Haven't seen it in a few years, so I'm going to have to revisit it. It does turn up on TCM here. And, yeah, I do want to see Christopher Jones and Sarah Miles. Sarah Miles I like because she got her kid off a lot, and she was always quite sexy to me, and she had acting chops and still does. She's a ditzy old lady now. She might have died a couple of years ago. I'm pretty sure she might have. But anyway, leaving aside that dithering, Christopher Jones, yeah, he had his heyday. He was a kind of contemporary of Michael Parks, and both of them were slightly in the James Deaney mould at the time. I do have a movie of his that I kind of like called Chabasco, where he plays a kind of fisherman. Richard Egan's in that one as well, and it's a 1960s kind of film, but it's a little bit different, and it's got a few chops to it. I found a good copy of it recently on the interwebs, and if you want to check that one out, Chabasco is not a bad one to do. So let's see if we've got anything else in the way of feeding back. I did get an email from Morris as well. He says, "Hey Terry, cool idea to have a Halloween episode of Paleo Cinema. I'll listen to it while giving the trick-or-treaters their bag of muesli flavored halva." Sorry about that, Morris. I didn't end up doing the Halloween one. "Your Facebook page suggests listeners recall their first scary movie. I'm really struggling to recall what mine was, but I do remember being freaked out as a five-year-old watching the deadly Ernest crawl out of his coffin in the TV hosting of whatever Z-grade movie of the week. Whatever was a Z-grade movie of the week." Yeah, there were four deadly Ernests in Australia who were all doing horror movie hosting gigs here. There was one in Brisbane. I think Shane Porteous played the one in Brisbane. There was one in Adelaide. There was one in Melbourne, which is probably the one Morris is talking about. And there was Ian Bannon, a guy called Ian Bannon in Sydney, who played Deadly Ernest, kind of looking like Harry Palmer in the Ipcress file. But, so let me continue. "No offence to good old Deadly, but why did the Yanks get Elvira or we got Deadly Ernest? Good point, we needed sexy things. We had Tabitha in the early days of Foxtel and cable TV here in Australia. We had a chick called Tabitha Clutterbuck doing movies on the Arena Channel before Arena went very middle of the road. And so there are some, you can find some of her stuff on YouTube. But we did belatedly get a kind of cult movie host who was quite sexy. Here we go. Back to Morris now. Another TV show that scared me as a younger was an Australian show hosted by, for no apparent reason, by Anthony Quayle. Each episode had a different tale, probably trying to emulate Alfred Hitchcock Presents. I struggled to recall many of the episodes, but I remember the first one I saw was about a house intruder who had the tables turned on him by the people whose house he invaded. It scared me shitless as a 10-year-old. I found an episode on the net recently and was amazed how bad it actually was. Yep, that would have been The Evil Touch with Anthony Quayle, and I think you can find some of them on YouTube and other places like that, so it might be worth checking out The Evil Touch. And they always had Anthony Quayle narrating the thing with lots of smoke in front of him. It's like there were like 65 cancer jockeys sitting down underneath the camera for all the smoke in front of Anthony Quayle for those things. And back to Morris again. The first scary movie I recall, but probably wasn't the first I saw, was Dario Argento's Profondo Rosso. That's Deep Red. Saw this as a 13-year-old way before I was allowed to. The score by Goblin, the strong use of colours, lights and knives by Argento, and the mounting tension had me sleepless and thinking about this film for weeks after I saw it. Now how do I keep my 13-year-old son from dragging it out of the DVD shelf? Cheers, Morris. The way you do it is this. You electrify the DVD shelf. That's the only thing I've got for you. Argento is an interesting one. I went and saw Argento Suspiria. You were talking previously in the voicemail about movies you walked out of. I walked out of Suspiria. Now, there's a good reason for this. I was quite young at the time, and I was going through a deep depression and a bit of a mental breakdown at the time. And if you go into the cinema during those circumstances, the last thing you want to see is a Dario Argento film. It fucks with your head way too much. And I just found it unbearable at the time. I haven't been able to watch it since. I'm going to have to toughen up, get back on the horse and watch Suspiria again, because I didn't find out how it ended. But I just found it too disturbing for the mental state I was in. And maybe we do have to take that into consideration a little bit. Our mental states when we do watch certain films. I think it's quite important to look after yourself in that sense, and not inflict things on yourself because you just think you need to. Anyway, that's about it for the feedback, and that's about it for this bumper episode. I'd like to thank everybody who subscribes. Leave reviews on iTunes if you can, and then email me and let me know that they're there if you would like to. You can go to the Facebook page. You can go to the Paleo-Cinema Cafe on Facebook, and Zom drops in occasionally and dumps some things there, and I'm always happy to have input to that page. You can friend me up on Facebook if you haven't already. Emails to cultguru@gmail.com. And I do recommend a whole bunch of other podcasts, the B-Movie Cast, Gentleman's Guide to Midnight Cinema, Silver and Gold. Look, there's so many of them, but I'll get them in a second. I'm just looking them up because we've got a lot of associations here. Love That Album, which is Morris's music podcast. I recommend that. He gets some very interesting people on it. It's only in the early days, but it's got the chops and it's definitely worth listening to. I listened to a couple of episodes, even though the music's not to my style. I love the way you do it, Morris, and I really should throw some feedback your way in a more formal sense. Basically, go to paleo-cinema.com. Down the left-hand side, there are a whole bunch of links to various blogs and other bits and pieces. Try out things like Shooting the Pooh, The Writer and the Critic, Galactic Suburbia, just any kind of podcast that grabs your fancy. I do have a preference for podcasts which aren't arch and cynical about what they're talking about. I find passion much more interesting. So all of the ones I've talked about, there is a great passion to them and a great care and regard for the stuff they're talking about. And I really like that kind of podcast. And so please avail yourself of all of those, and I will be back in 2 weeks' time. I may get a guest in. This renovation's got me really up in the air, but I may have a guest in, or I may just go to the K part of the A to Z project. Until things settle down here, I really don't know what I'm going to be doing. So thank you for listening to this experiment if you got this far. I'm going to play a little music to get us out of here, and take care and look after yourselves and enjoy your movies. The dancer, she doesn't run away. The dancer.
treasure.